This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Going green can lead to a pocketful of greenbacks. In this portion of the program, we're going to take a look at how businesses are using green strategies to boost revenues and image. We'll also talk about all these claims of being green. How green are all the products and services that are labeled green? Our guest is Andrew Winston. He is the director of the Corporate Environmental Strategy Project at Yale and the co-author with Daniel Esty of Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage. The book looks at companies that are doing business in new ways. The authors say these companies look up and down the value chain, keeping, quote, environmental impacts firmly in mind. The authors say, quote, they know that working to protect the planet also protects their own companies by safeguarding their assets, inspiring current employees, and attracting valuable new knowledge workers looking for more than a paycheck. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The book Green to Gold is published by Yale. You can visit the authors and learn more at the website www.eco-advantage.com. Questions and comments for our guest, Andrew Winston, are welcome. You can join us with a phone call. Here are the numbers, 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Andrew Winston, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. Glad to
be
here.
Sure. One of the things you say in the introduction to Green to Gold is this: the environment is not a fringe issue. Is there a moment in time you can point to and say, this was the tipping point in the mainstream interest in green business practices and products?
You know, it's an interesting question about where the tipping point came. I don't know if there's one particular moment. I think this winter, in general, there was a significant shift, and you saw a ton of media coverage right after the new year on business magazines, all kinds of magazines, newspapers. The Wall Street Journal now has regular coverage of green business issues, and it happened, you know, sort of in the months after Al Gore's movie Inconvenient Truth. And I think he pushed things along quite a bit. And then a couple big companies in mid-late 2006 really started pressuring the companies around them and their own suppliers, like Walmart and GE. And they're so big that they can't be ignored. And then I think there was a tipping point in the winter, in part because people went out and just had strange weather and saw that this climate change thing was actually happening and was very real, and it made them wonder what they were doing, what their companies were doing, what the companies they buy products from were doing, and it just changed the whole conversation. So I think the corporate America has really moved very far in the last 6 months.
It's very interesting. There is a company that you write about in the book, and I think they call their approach TINA. There is no alternative. This is something we've got to do.
Right. That's Shell Oil, the European execs that I met with while writing the book. You know, they use that acronym, TINA, to just, you know, tell themselves that they didn't really have a choice. And, you know, they have executives dedicated to the issue of climate change and the issue of biodiversity, which is about the web of life and species and land use. And the reason these things matter is because they need to go out and dig and find the energy that we all need. And they're now recognizing that they have to take into account their impacts on the environment and how they do their business. And there's not an alternative. The local communities, their customers, the press, everybody's asking these tough questions. And I think it sets the tone for businesses to understand that when there's no alternative, then you can either sulk about it or you can take up the challenge and create an opportunity for yourself.
Yeah. Is business being pushed to be green, or do they see that it's to their advantage?
It's both. I mean, I think the leading companies, a lot of the ones we talk about in the book, you know, they see it, they get it, they've seen the value to their company. I think a lot of companies are feeling probably a little bit pushed, but you know, it's sort of how you define it. Is it pushed when you say, well, all of our employees really care about this? I guess that's pushed, but at the same time, it's all your employees. It's the people that make up the company. You know, so the top leadership might be feeling a little bit of squeeze from their own employees and from outside stakeholders, as they call it. But the people internally, they want their company to do more. They want them to be green. So I think it's both desire and need.
It's kind of a push-pull situation.
Absolutely.
The first story you tell in the book is about Sony and its very expensive Christmas. What what happened there?
Well, it was about 6 years and six years ago now, 2001. A few weeks before Christmas, which is clearly a big time for a consumer products company, they were shipping their PlayStation 2 to the European market. They had 1.3 million boxes of PlayStation 2s that were stopped by Dutch customs officials. This was the whole shipment to Europe for the Christmas season. And the issue was they found, the Dutch customs people found a little bit of cadmium, a toxic chemical, a toxic element in the wires of the game controls. So this is the things that all the kids are going to be holding and sitting in their laps, and this was just not allowed. And, you know, Sony didn't know where it came from, and they spent they rushed some parts to Europe, cost a fortune. They ended up spending over $100 million over the next couple years trying to figure out what had happened and tracing it back to a very small supplier in China that had used this element as part of their process. And it really taught Sony and a lot of companies that they need to understand exactly where everything's coming from and what's in everything that goes into their products. And this is where we're headed now, where companies are going to track that in a more real way.
And now let's turn our attention here for a moment to the story of the recall of Thomas the Tank Engine toys.
That's right. I mean,
what a mess.
Yeah, it is a mess. It's really a modern version of it, I guess, and people are realizing that, you know, especially when you get something that goes to your kids, and I had that train at home for my son, it really does reach people. And that's why we're seeing the growth of some product markets like organic foods. It's, you know, for people, it's about their health. It's about their kids' health. And you know, that gets people very worked up and for good reason.
And I wonder what the repercussions are going to be for the health of the company, the RC2, the company licensed to make the toys.
Right. Well, I think it's a matter of how you handle these things. I always feel like people understand that there are errors and there are problems. It's how you handle those problems. You know, the famous case of Tylenol in the 80s, and Johnson & Johnson just, you know, stepped in, recalled all of the Tylenol bottles, even though it wasn't their fault that someone had poisoned their product. And they didn't step back and say, oh, it's not our fault. They just took responsibility and took care of it. And it was a classic case of saving the company. And it's just a matter of how these, you know, what's bad in these cases is when a company that owns the brand, you know, the Thomas, and says, well, that's not us. That's the people who made it. Because customers don't care, really. I mean, and we don't care who made it. And you know, it's a very subtle distinction, you know, who you contracted out to manufacture your product. They care about the brand. They care about the company that sold them the thing. And that's part of the reason understanding your supply chain is so important these days.
Yeah, there have got to be a lot of challenges companies face in making certain the products they make and the products they use in manufacturing are safe.
Absolutely. It's a big challenge. And, you know, there's more and more going on about what they call auditing your supply chain and asking tough questions of your suppliers. What's in everything? How is it made? Who's making it? Are the local and international laws about worker rights and child labor, are those all being observed? And, you know, how much energy are you using? What toxics are you using? And asking all the environmental questions. And now the really, you know, the leading companies are not only asking these questions and just, you know, trusting their suppliers, they're going and auditing them themselves. They're going on site and looking to see if these things are happening. And it's changing the way things are made around the world, because once a few big companies ask their suppliers to think through and be very careful about what they're doing, it then affects, you know, every other company that buys from that supplier.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Andrew Winston, co-author of Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Look forward to your telephone calls, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now. Calling in from Champaign. Line 1, hi. We have a caller there on line 1? No, apparently not. maybe they will call back if we have disconnected them somehow or other. I want to talk with you about, you know, green is so hot right now, and I think that you would say it's not a trend. This is the way it's going to be. But we are so focused on this now. In the New York Times this week, a headline read, "At Home Depot, how green is that chainsaw?" And what Home Depot had done was to invite companies that they buy from to make a pitch to have their products included in the retailer's Eco Options marketing campaign. And here's some of the pitches to Home Depot as reported by The Times. Plastic-handled paintbrushes were touted as nature-friendly because they were not made of wood. Wood-handled paintbrushes were promoted as better for the planet because they were not made of plastic. An electric chainsaw, green, because it was not gas-powered. A bug zapper, ditto, because it was not a poisonous spray. Manufacturers of paint thinners, electrical screwdrivers, and interior overhead lights claimed similar bragging rights simply because their plastic or cardboard packaging was recyclable. And then Home Depot VP, Ron Jarvis, says, this isn't good enough. What are your thoughts about the Eco Options Initiative, the claims made by companies who made a green pitch hoping to jump on the bandwagon, and the response of Home Depot to those claims?
Well, I think, you know, what you're getting at is something you know, that's very challenging, which is it's not always easy to know what's the greener option, and it's a complicated question because in many of those cases, they all may be right. They may be better in certain ways. You know, plastic sometimes is better than wood because you could, if it's recyclable, and you can use it over and over and over again. And it depends on where the wood comes from. And so there's a lot of it depends. And I think what that means is that customers are going to very much need some help, and they're going to need labels that they can trust. And you know, there's a few out there like Energy Star that the government puts out, the EPA coordinates. And, you know, if you know you got an Energy Star computer, you know it's probably more energy efficient than some others. Energy Star appliances have sold very well. So you need labels, and there's a lot of movement in that area. There are some very established ones in Europe, and we just don't have them quite yet here. But you're also going to need the companies that are selling it to do more to screen these things. So, it, you know, it's a good sign if Home Depot says, you know, this isn't good enough. They're, unfortunately, going to need to figure out some of these things themselves and figure out the standards they want to set on certain kinds of products. They can't entirely trust their suppliers and the companies pitching them things. So they're going to need to work with some respected outside advisors, NGOs, consultants, to help them produce some guidelines, energy use for products, what's in the products, and decide what an eco option product really should be. Because when they started this program a couple months ago, they really just started labeling a lot of things they already had, and that was the first step. You know, the question is, will companies start producing new things for them that really are a step greener than what they've done before? And they're going to have to do some of that screening and understanding what really makes something green.
Hmm. What kind of opportunities are available to a big box retailer like Home Depot, other than, you know, obviously selling products that they label, you know, this gets our stamp of approval? Are there other opportunities for them?
Absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing now is from Walmart is really quite astonishing. They are really leading the charge on environmental issues related to retail. They are doing a tremendous amount around their stores and how they're built and the energy they use. They already were fairly advanced on this because, as everyone knows, they're very cost conscious. So anything that cuts cost was already something they wanted to do, and they had, you know, neat software in their stores that gauged the light coming in from the outside and would lower the internal lights if there was enough light coming through the skylights. And this wasn't that common in retail, but they were already doing it. But then they set even more aggressive goals in the last year about how to cut their energy use, and they found sometimes very simple, sort of funny things like the refrigerated cases that, you know, fill a whole aisle and you can feel all the cold air coming off of them. They're doing some test stores now where they've put doors on those cases and cut energy use 70% in that aisle. And that's really astonishing and very simple. And they're finding many, many things like that. So we're going to see a huge change in how retail operates, the energy they use. And Walmart is asking their suppliers to cut back, way back on packaging. And that's another way we're going to see changes. We're going to see in stores products that just don't have the packaging they used to. You know, 10, 15 years ago, every box, every deodorant on the shelf came in a box, if you recall. Those boxes are gone.
Yeah, they are gone.
And that's pretty much because of Walmart, because they asked, just for cost reasons, you know, 5, 10 years ago, that their suppliers start getting rid of them because they're not needed.
Yeah. You
know? And so we're going to see a lot of that. And so there's much more they can do besides just labeling and marketing the products in how they operate.
Yeah. Are they listening to consumers about these issues? You know, for example, yesterday evening, I went into the drawer in the kitchen and pulled out saran wrap. And I thought to myself, why do I buy this whole box every time, you know, we run out of it? Why can't I just buy the saran and put it in a box that I've got at home?
Right. There's some of that going on. I think they're starting to get innovative about those kinds of questions. And do you even need a box? It gets very challenging, though, because, you know, there's a use for boxes. There's coupons, there's communication, there's marketing, there's nutritional info, what have you. And so there's going to be some trade-offs, and I think, retailers are going to maybe need to come up with unique ways of selling things. Maybe there's going to be more signage in stores with some of that information that was on a box. And, I think, but you're getting at something which is, treating products almost like a service. You don't buy the box, you just buy the thing you need, which is just the saran. And there's going to be more of that. You're probably going to see more, cereal boxes that just do the plastic inside with some branding and labeling on it. But then there's issues about how it's transported and how much gets crushed. And, you know, there's trade-offs in all these things. And I think we're finding that it isn't always easy. But if you're creative about it and people try to be innovative, they can find ways around some of these issues.
Yeah. Are environmental initiatives typically the responsibility of one division of a company, or are the really successful companies who are green, are these initiatives embedded in every aspect of a company's operation?
Well, it really varies a tremendous amount. I mean, the easy answer is that the best companies in this arena, the leading ones, do make it a part of everybody's job. I mean, that's where it needs to be, where everybody thinks about it. It's a part of what they do. At the same time, you know, you need some people focused on it and collecting information and finding best practices and, you know, maybe doing some of the product development with an eye towards green. But in general, it's best if you get it into everybody's life. And the smart companies are finding ways to give tools to their employees. You know, they're giving designers checklists of things, maybe particular chemicals or substances they shouldn't use and ones they can use as much as they want, and helping them, because, you know, not everyone can understand all these trade-offs like we talked about before. It's complicated. But you need someone to do that research and someone to focus on it, but then provide the tools so that everybody can think about it. And that's definitely where we're headed. We're seeing more and more of that. So you've got companies creating very, very senior environmental positions, you know, reporting to the CEO, but not having huge staffs, you know, making it their job to get it embedded throughout the organization.
Yeah, that's interesting, too. This is kind of a related issue, the issue of innovative culture within the workplace, within a company. This is a benefit that you call a soft benefit to going green. Talk with us about that.
Well, you know, fundamentally, I see four big buckets of value creation for companies in thinking green. You know, and some of them are very concrete, and others are a little bit harder to put numbers on. Two are about reducing the downside, the bad things for the business, reducing cost and reducing risk. And two are on the upside, increasing revenue, you know, driving new products and selling more and getting more customers and selling. And finally, the fourth bucket is intangible value, this brand value. That's very hard to measure. But for some companies that have big brands and are consumer-facing, you know, brand value is more than half of their value, more than half of the market capitalization of that stock or that company, a company like Coca-Cola or big consumer products companies. And so this kind of value in perception of the company, both from your customers, your employees, your communities, is very valuable, very hard to build up, and very easy to destroy. Something goes wrong, and you can lose, you know, we talked about Thomas the Tank Engine. If they don't handle it right, they could lose a lot of value, and people will be wary of using their products. And the green stuff really fits into that camp quite a bit. You're doing things that cut costs, and you're doing things that reduce risk, and you're doing things, hopefully, that create new products. But you're often doing things that are the right thing to do and really help build your brand. And the leading companies, they don't let the fact that they can't measure it perfectly keep them from pursuing it and keep them from including it in their own cost-benefit analyses. They include these things that are hard to measure and just say, you know, I don't know the exact number, but it's not zero. And that means we're going to do this thing, even if it seems like it costs more than we'd like.
Hmm. Well, that's a great question. Is payback certain?
Well, never is. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that, you know, we tried to do in Green to Gold that we think hadn't been done before and we found that readers really appreciate is talk about what doesn't work. And we have a chapter called, you know, Why Eco-Initiatives Fail. You know, because for so long the discussion about greening of business was about win-win. You know, if you thought about being green, you were definitely going to profit. And, you know, the payback was almost immediate and it was definite. And that's just not realistic. You know, I came from a business background. I had responsibility for, you know, P&L statements in my company. And that meant that I would try things and some wouldn't work and some would. And it's important to tell people, you know, hey, this isn't easy. It isn't always win-win. It's like every other business initiative. If you try to market a new product, you're going to fail sometimes. If you try to develop a new product or get into a new market, these things can fail. And, you know, we talk about why that's the case and how to avoid some of those hurdles. You know, the payback is not guaranteed. You got to do it right. You got to think it through. You got to do all the normal, you know, what we call blocking and tackling, the things you do in a business. You figure out what your market's going to be. You figure out what the product should be. You talk to customers. You see if they're going to satisfy their needs. And you market it right. And you still may fail. You know, there's lots of reasons things don't work. But it's not easy, and it's not a guaranteed payback.
What's a P&L statement?
What's a P&L statement?
Yeah.
You know, profit and loss. It's,
okay.
You know, how you think about your business. It's the classic financial tool for looking at a business. You know, how much are you making? How much are you potentially losing?
It's your spreadsheet, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah, it's the financial statement, part of what you report to Wall Street, and to, you know, it's regulated, and it's what businesses basically are the lifeblood, and it's what people often think the environment doesn't touch on, but it really is directly related.
Yeah. What are the most common reasons for environmental initiatives to fail businesses?
You know, there's a lot of reasons that, you know, both internal and external. I think, you know, a couple things that I think are sort of big hurdles and that can go wrong is sometimes companies, you know, perhaps focus on the wrong issue. They're trying to go green. Their heart's in the right place. But they're maybe not focusing on the thing that matters the most for their business. And so it's, in some sense, just not strategic. The example that we use is Ford Motor. And, you know, they've been having a lot of problems in recent years and losing a lot of money. You know, but even 5 to 10 years ago, they were doing pretty well. And they decided, under the leadership of Bill Ford, who was the CEO and is the chairman, and he's a very, sincere environmentalist. He really does believe and get it. And he convinced his company, he was in charge, but to build a green factory. They were going to spend $2 billion to make over one of their big famous factories that had been there since the days of Henry Ford. And they put on a grass roof, and they did all this thing with water capture, and it is a very green factory, and that's a good thing in and of itself. But the factory is not really the main part of their environmental issue. The real impact that Ford has is not just their manufacturing, but their cars and the gas that the cars burn. And they didn't focus as much on building greener cars, cars that had better fuel efficiency. Toyota did, and Toyota is now the largest car company in the world. They passed GM, they passed Ford last year and GM this year. And, you know, that's just an indication of focusing in some sense on the wrong thing, on the thing that really matters for your environmental impact. You know, the other big thing I see is something we call the middle management squeeze, that executives who are sort of in the middle of the company, they run a factory or they run a piece of the business, the CEO comes out and says they have to be green, and the employees are all excited about it, and the guys in the middle have to make it happen. And they're often told, okay, now you got to reduce your emissions or you got to do something greener, but they still have their regular goals. They have to cut costs and they have to get their product out the door. And sometimes those goals don't mesh, and it's a really big challenge, and it's a hard organizational hurdle for companies.
Hmm. Tell us about a couple of the companies you call wave riders.
Yeah, those are that's the name we gave to companies we think are focusing on this and thinking the most about environmental issues and probably the clearest about it. A couple of my favorites, one is IKEA, which is, Swedish-based furniture company. Everybody's probably been to their stores. You know, they just have a very, there's a cultural thing there. I mean, they are privately held, which does make it a little bit easier. But there's a cultural focus on doing the right thing by society and by the environment. But they've translated that in a very real way into the way they do business. They track, going back to what I said earlier about supply chain and understanding where everything comes from, they understand where all the wood in their furniture comes from. And, they don't make furniture, and they don't actually cut down trees. They buy from the companies that make the furniture for them. And so they could argue it's not even our responsibility where the wood comes from. But they do. They trace it back. They take responsibility, and they go and they audit the furniture makers, and they go back to the forests around the world and try to understand if there's any illegal logging going on and if the wood is being harvested in a sustainable, eco-friendly fashion. And they're doing their best to make sure that as much of the wood comes from sustainable sources as possible. And they design their products with chemicals and toxics in mind and trying to reduce that, and energy use for the kinds of lights and lamps and things they sell. They just have a very thorough attitude about it. And there's other companies like 3M or DuPont, big industrial companies that have been cutting waste and cutting emissions for years, working on this for 15, 20, 30 years, and finding new ways every year to cut their own greenhouse gas emissions and their contribution to climate change and other problems. So these companies are thinking in a very, very long-term way and a very broad way about their impact. They think about their suppliers and what they do, and they think about their customers and what they do. They don't just say, we've got this factory and this office building, and that's all that matters. They think in a very big way about it.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Andrew Winston, co-author of Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener on a cell phone. Line one, hi.
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 I have a question, kind of a long shot maybe for the guest, about so when a business wants to make a change of this kind, I would guess that sometimes they just don't know where to start, and perhaps they hire consultants. And I was wondering, I've heard of a particular type of like an MBA in environmental sustainability degree, and I just wondered if the guest knows of programs like this where someone who's interested in becoming someone who could do that type of thing could go.
That's a good question.
Yeah, it's great. I do consulting. There's a number of people that focus in this arena. Just so people, if they want to see sort of the kind of work I do, just as a quick plug, they can go to andrewwinston.com and just see information about me and the work I do. But I think, part of what you're asking is about how do people take it into their own lives and how do they become someone who works on this. There's a number of programs out there. There's a few MBA programs that are focused on sustainable business, one at the Presidio School in San Francisco and one at the Bainbridge up in Seattle area. And there's a few others. And then there's programs that are joint degrees with a top-notch MBA program and an environmental school at the same university. I did my master's in environmental management at Yale, and that's where I met my co-author, who's a professor, and that's how we started to work together on this book. And there's an environment school that's one of the best in the world, I think, and an MBA program that's fantastic. And there's people who come and get joint degrees; they get a degree in both. And there's people doing that at Michigan, UNC. Duke. I mean, there's a whole list of very, very top schools. There's a study out there that comes out every year called Beyond Gray Pinstripes that an organization does that looks at the MBA programs and which ones are looking at social and environmental issues. And I recommend finding that resource, and that would give people some ideas about where to go.
Thanks. That's exactly what I wanted.
Great. No problem.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi. My question is, I realize that it's a very important for all these factors to be there. I haven't read the book, but I really want to. Anyhow, I wonder if the author could comment on that. I wonder how I can read the book. Is it out in talking books? Because I'm reduced to talking books.
I'm actually sorry to say that we don't have an audio book yet. But I will pass that on to. I've been asked that lately a few times. I will pass that on to my publisher, and ask that they consider putting out an audio book. Right now, it's just available in, you know, Barnes and Noble and Amazon and in hardcover.
Yeah. Okay. What a great question. You know, going back to the caller who wanted to know about programs at university level, this kind of the green wave, the green trend, is business, the experience that businesses, corporations, and so on are having, trying to go green for the variety of reasons that we talked about. Are they turning out to be an example for institutions like colleges and universities?
I think it's working both ways. I mean, absolutely. I think MBA programs around the world are going to take this much more seriously when they see that they're fundamentally their clients are the businesses that hire their students, right? And you know, when they see them talk about this and take it seriously, and they're starting to build it into the curriculum. But I think they're also getting the pressure from their students. There are a number of organizations, one's called Net Impact, that is a series of clubs around the country at business schools with people joining that are interested in social and environmental issues and making that a part of their career. And there's more and more surveys showing that MBA students care about this and really want to find a company to work for that agrees with their values. So I think it's working both ways. Students are pressuring their own university, certainly at the undergraduate level. There's lots of greening of campus initiatives, local food programs so that the cafeterias are buying locally and buying organic, and there's all sorts of initiatives going on. So I think we're seeing a new generation that thinks of this as just a normal way to do things and the right way to do things, and doesn't want to hear that there's a sacrifice between business and green. And I think as the title Green to Gold says in a pretty unsubtle way, there doesn't have to be if you do it right and strategically. There isn't a trade-off, and then you don't have to have businesses, scrambling to satisfy these new young employees. They can just be doing the right thing and doing it in a profitable way.
Yeah, here at the University of Illinois, there's a big push for energy conservation, and I would imagine that people in the university are, trying to weigh those costs and advantages of, what can we do, where will it pay off, where do we start, and so on and so forth.
Yep.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Andrew Winston, co-author of Green to Gold, his co-author, Daniel Esty. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, questions, comments are invited, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I visited your blog at the other website, Eco Advantage, www.ecoadvantage.com, and you were recently in Shanghai, China.
Right.
And you saw some evidence that green business practices are in play there. What did you see?
Well, China's growing so fast, and I was in Shanghai, which is probably one of the more modern cities in the world now because they're building buildings so quickly. And you can see that China is catching up to us in terms of energy use and greenhouse gas emissions. Some estimate this year they're going to pass us in greenhouse gas emissions. So it's a serious issue. And they have air pollution and water pollution in ways that we haven't seen for decades in our country. But you see it. You see the conversation in just one day. One issue of the Shanghai Daily, an English language newspaper there. There were a few different articles about the environment, about business, about pollution and how, companies were not always following the rules. And so at least they're having that conversation there where you think they maybe wouldn't. And there were articles about the upside, the green to gold kind of stories about companies that were going to be able to sell more of their environmentally preferable products because China was, you know, increasing regulations on green building and what kind of glass you would use in the windows. So there was an article about a Norwegian or Finnish glass company that was going to sell a ton of product in China. And there were articles about the Toyota Prius, the hybrid gas electric car, and the cars Toyota was selling in China. So you're seeing the conversation there as much as here. It's a global phenomenon. And that was very exciting for me to see that it wasn't just something happening in the West. It was happening everywhere. Because, as I said before, people are seeing the weather, they're seeing the change happening, and they know that we need to get going. And so it is a global conversation, and it needs to be.
Mm. Is it affecting small businesses as much as the big players?
I think, you know, the small businesses, I think, can do a lot of the same things as the big business. And they're feeling it in different ways, probably. But as soon as some of their big customers, you know, if they have corporate customers, as soon as they start asking their suppliers to be greener, and that includes the small guys, then they feel it. And I think, small local businesses that have customers come in and start to ask about these things are definitely seeing it and feeling it and seeing opportunities to be the ones who solve the problems and provide greener products and greener solutions to their customers. It's really sort of the same set of issues. You know, they don't have the same power as the big guys to ask, you know, to ask their suppliers to do more, but they can provide new products and new ideas for their customers and build brand value and cut costs and do all the same things the big guys do.
Mm. What are the big guys doing in terms of how they conducting business in a green way in the developing world?
That's, you know, it's an interesting question. People used to talk about the that companies would go abroad or try to find a developing country where the regulations weren't as good. And I'm sure that does happen to some extent. But, you know, the companies I spoke with the most for the book are really leading and think about their brand and how they're perceived around the world. And so they really act the same way everywhere, fundamentally. But more importantly, it's actually often good business for them because, you know, if you're Intel and you make semiconductor chips, you don't really want to be making things differently in different places. It's really expensive to do that. So once you have a way of doing it, you're going to do that everywhere. And in their case, you know, they even were shipping some hazardous waste from parts of the world where they didn't think that the country was going to handle it right, and they would ship it back to the U.S. or somewhere nearby where they could manage it well. So, I'm sure there are still companies that try to take advantage of looser regulations, but I think for the most part, the green pressure and how global it is and the rise of transparency, meaning, you know, somebody with a cell phone camera and a blog can put something up online and show you doing something wrong anywhere in the world. I think that kind of transparency means companies, they don't really have anywhere to run to, and they're going to raise the standards in the developing world rather than seek ones that are lower.
Yeah. I was encouraged by a comment that an executive in a Dutch company, I can't remember now if it was a banking business or what, but doing business in the developing world, and he told you, companies cannot succeed in societies that fail.
Right. Right, it's absolutely true. I think it was probably ABN AMRO, the Dutch bank. This is what they're seeing. It's, you know, there's a lot of discussion about sustainability and social issues versus environmental, and I think the thinking is starting to evolve, and companies and pundits and academics are really starting to see that the two are intertwined. That you don't have a clean environment without raising people out of the poverty level so that they have choices. And you don't really raise people out of poverty without handling major environmental issues, such as clean water. It's the biggest environmental issue around the world, frankly, that hits the most people. And it's the biggest source of disease and keeping people in poverty. You know, the 2 billion or so that don't have clean water, don't have access to clean water. So these issues are totally interrelated. And the fact that, you know, the emissions that we produce in the developing world, and for greenhouse gas emissions, they affect everybody everywhere, and they disproportionately hurt the poor who can't adjust if the oceans rise or there's stronger storms. They have to run and become, you know, what people are calling climate refugees, and so we are impacting the poor the most, and so we have some responsibility to try to address poverty and environment together.
Mm. One of the companies that has done a great deal to turn around a very bad reputation by being more responsible is Chiquita. Want to talk a little bit about that company?
Yeah, they're sort of a fun story. I mean, they Chiquita Brands or Chiquita Bananas, if you were going to go back in history 30, 40 years and sort of name the worst offenders on social responsibility, they would be up there. I mean, they funded some coups in Central America because they didn't like the government and how it was. And these are democratically elected governments. They helped fund coups because they didn't like the way the agricultural policies were going. You know, and this was a long time ago, but I think that was what was behind the phrase Banana Republic. It came from that interaction. And they, in the early 90s, started talking to their critics and sitting down with the Rainforest Alliance in particular about the way they grew bananas. And they were they're sort of a classic example now of sitting down and really listening to where these people are coming from and maybe not just assuming that they're just going to be critical or that they're not going to listen back. And they started to work together, and they've been working together for 15 or so years and developed a program for how they grow bananas. And now they're you know, sort of an award-winning social responsibility company for their very open and transparent reports about everything that goes on their farms, how close those farms are to the standards that the Rainforest Alliance has helped them set, called the Better Banana Program. And they really are an example of you know, you can open yourself up, and if you do it in a smart way with a partner, you're not necessarily going to get slammed. As long as you're working on those issues, people will give you some space to work on them, as long as they know that you're sincere about it.
Mm. Has it had an effect on their bottom line, or is it just in terms of the value of that brand name, that brand image, and an issue of consumer trust?
Well, it's both. I mean, by their count, they've saved tens of millions of dollars on just running more efficiently, running better in these new ways. I mean, some things cost more, some things save them money, but on balance, they believe that it has really saved them money. But it's partly about brand and sales. They were under pressure at the time they started to make this change from customers, especially in Europe, about the way they grew their bananas and the way their products were made. So yeah, it's a brand issue, but it also directly relates to sales. They had pressure from big bulk buyers, big co-ops, that were maybe not going to buy from them if they didn't change their way. So it works on all dimensions.
Yeah. And the companies you call wave riders, like the company that you mentioned earlier, IKEA, is there a way to kind of say, well, this has really served them well across the board? Are the wave riders, are they doing well?
Well, they're doing well by, I think, in a number of dimensions. One of the charts we have early on is stock price of the top 50 wave riders. We put together a ranking based on a lot of different sources of information, really before we went out and interviewed them, just to say, well, who are the perceived leaders and who are the ones that are doing the most, and let's figure out which ones we want to go talk to. And then we just looked at the stock price, and the stock of these companies has outperformed the market by quite a lot over the last 10 years. You know, it's very hard to say what's cause and effect. No one can say, oh, that's directly why. And usually the argument that I think is the most compelling is that these companies are well run, and the environment and the way they handle environmental issues is an indication of how well run they are. And stock price is another outcome of being a well-run company. So I think it's a correlation rather than cause and effect, but it's an important one, and it's a way to find companies that are doing good things and will remain profitable. They're protecting their license to operate is the phrase people use, their existence. And that's what Walmart has said. You know, it's our license to grow. Walmart has faced challenges in trying to open up new stores in a lot of communities because mm-hmm. they're not so sure about them. And this gives them a chance to show that they're doing the right thing and get communities behind them and allow themselves to grow as a business.
Are we seeing a growth in the interest and making investments that are socially responsible?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a segment of the investment population that's socially responsible investing. It's still fairly small. You know, there's trillions and trillions of dollars in assets, but there's pockets out there of the financial world that are moving this way very rapidly. The venture capital community, you know, based mainly in Silicon Valley, is spending a lot of money, billions, on what they call clean tech, and that is often means renewable energy. But it's a lot of different companies now, companies that are helping us get to a different kind of economy that help us reduce emissions and carbon. And so we're seeing investments in that way. We're seeing banks reviewing loans for what they call project finance, big projects like dams and factories and things, to see if they're going to take care of environmental and social issues. So banks are starting to ask tougher questions. There's still a long way to go there. I mean, Wall Street and analysts of stocks probably don't care about this as much as many companies would like, but there are pockets in the financial community that are very serious about it.
There we have to leave. We're out of time. Andrew Winston, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Winston is co-author with Daniel Esty of Green to Gold, How Smart Companies Use Environmental Strategy to Innovate, Create Value, and Build Competitive Advantage. The book is published by Yale. You can visit the authors and learn more at www.eco-advantage.com. And our guest this afternoon, Andrew Winston, you can visit him at www.andrewwinston.com.